My name is Sarah Causer, and I'm joined today by David Levin, the Senior Program Manager and Diversity Coordinator at the Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, as well as Dr. Darla Donkey-Demont, who is the Associate Provost for Global Initiatives from Coastal Carolina University. If David, do you want to introduce yourself first?
Yes, I'm happy to be here, and thank you all for tuning in, and I hope that you will find the webinar beneficial.
And Darla, can you hear us?
I can. Can you all hear me?
Yes, you're coming through.
Awesome. Wonderful. Yes, it's wonderful to be with everyone today, and we're so excited about this program. Happy to have the opportunity to visit with others.
Wonderful. So today we're basically going to be hearing from David first, who will talk about the Fulbright overview as well as the Outreach Lecturing Fund. He'll also go into the objectives that the OLF has as well as the benefits to the host institutions and visiting scholars. And then Darla will actually talk about the impact that the OLF has had on her campus this past year. And finally, I'll wrap it up with going into the nitty-gritty details of how to apply and what you can expect. So basically, to kick it off, the Outreach Lecturing Fund is part of the Fulbright Scholar Program. Last year, they celebrated their 70th year, so they have been around for a long time, and the goal has really been to promote mutual understandings between the peoples of the United States and the rest of the world. At any given moment, there's about 800 to 850 visiting scholars in the U.S., so this program is really just to provide funding for these scholars to reach other institutions. So I will hand it over to David, and he can go into that a little bit more in detail.
Sarah, thank you very much. Yeah, the OLF program is so it's small, but it's powerful. It's unique in the sense that it lets you, as a campus administrator, bring a Fulbrighter who's already here in the U.S., typically doing their Fulbright scholar work, typically a researcher at one of the Carnegie One institutions, although they actually could be anywhere across the country. Idea is to bring them to your campus to help you take a nice step in terms of internationalization. The scholar would come to your campus, would engage in various kinds of things based on what you'd like to do to internationalize, and it's really a win-win for you and for them. It's a chance for you to bring a scholar to campus, it's a chance for you to engage with that scholar in a variety of ways. Typically, it's perhaps giving a lecture on campus to faculty, to students, about their country or their culture or the work they're doing as a Fulbrighter. We've also seen lots of examples where scholars engaged in the local community outside the campus, again, as a way of internationalizing your campus, your community through Fulbright. But there's a method to our madness in the sense that, any school could, in fact, host an outreach lecturer. We're giving preference to a number of schools that fall into certain categories that in general are seen as schools less engaged with Fulbright. So we'd like to see you take the outreach lecturing program as a way of not only bringing the scholar to your campus, but a way of learning more about Fulbright in general. So we're talking about minority-serving institutions. We're talking about community colleges. We're talking about small or large colleges. We're talking about women's colleges. We're talking to some extent about colleges that are in the rural area. Schools that have not had the opportunity to engage with Fulbright. So by bringing this scholar to your campus, we hope that you get a better sense of what Fulbright has to offer. That in fact you could host a scholar like this on your campus for an academic year through Fulbright Scholar in Residence. Or you could be sending your faculty or your students on Fulbright Scholar grants or Fulbright Student grants to the scholar's home country. So it really opens up the world of Fulbright to you and gives you a taste of it and gives you a better sense of really what's available. It's also really beneficial to the scholar because, you know, Fulbright is more than just an academic exchange program. We want these scholars to experience America and Americans in a variety of ways. So one of the best ways is to get them outside of their own campus, or outside of their classroom or their laboratory or the library, perhaps to another part of the country, perhaps to visit with another kind of academic institution. It enhances their American experience as a Fulbrighter. So it's really a win for them, and it's really also a win for you. And we hope that you will take advantage of this. You'll hear more about how this has specifically worked on a campus, and we'll also hear specifically how it operates and what the process entails. And I think you'll actually realize that it's a fairly easy process and a fairly fast turnaround. So I really hope that you take advantage of it.
Great. Thanks so much, David. After hearing that, before, as I mentioned, we're going to go into the application details in depth, we're going to hear from Darla real quick, so I can turn over the microphone to you, Darla, and whenever you want me to proceed to the next screen, just let me know.
Thank you very much. Well, as I said, it's a great pleasure to be with everyone today, and if we can look at the overview to the Coastal Carolina University's participation, just as David said, this has been a wonderful way to advance Fulbright, the awareness of not just this, but the range of programming involvement possible through Fulbright over the course of the last couple of years here on our campus. So we first started participating only a little over a year ago. We requested the opportunity to visit, to have four visiting scholars in the spring of 2016, providing lodging, meals, local transport, and a stipend of $300 for each scholar. We knew that this was a rather aggressive program to start with, but we felt like that would also help to engage a really broad spectrum. And if we can go to the next slide, this gives a picture of the OLF scholars who were invited by Coastal Carolina University in the spring of 2016. As you'll see, they represent a broad spectrum of issues as well as focal areas and geographic locations, and we were hosting them about one a month. Now, I will say that was, as I said, an aggressive program, but I will point out as well the colleague on the lower left there, Salio Dion, from Cheikh Anta Diop University in Senegal. We are just in the process of signing now an agreement of cooperation with them for very specific exchange and faculty research cooperation. So one of the clear benefits of this OLF program is getting people talking with each other on your campus, taking time and being able to establish in advance further promotion of your academic programs as well as research and creative trajectories as well, and we're excited about that. If we can go to the next slide, please. One of the first things that I think when we got started that was really important for us was making sure we really looked at the main site and the links, and we asked a lot of questions, as Sarah can certainly validate. We also brought together our campus stakeholders in advance to identify specific areas of targetable need and interest, as opposed to a general call or, you know, you can invite if you choose. I'd urge you, you'll have these slides, I'm sure. If you click on our Arts and Humanities Global Experience Program, you can see a lot more about this. But essentially, this led to a group of colleagues from around our campus who came together for topic areas, and then we looked at identifying a really clear set of benefits that we expected from the program on our campus. For example, for us, that included lifelong learning on our campus. It included one of our local community colleges, as David mentioned, who participate sometimes in Fulbright. And this was a natural to call them and to say, we're thinking about this. How could this be of benefit to you? And, in fact, they became an important part of our program for each colleague. If we can go to the next slide, we really wanted to focus on maximizing the immersive experience for both our campus stakeholders and the scholar, which meant agreeing upon the length of the visit, the dates that would work for the campus, the resource support, and being very clear about who was paying for what. We looked at the scholars themselves, given the parameters of how long they still need to be in the U.S., where they were located, and so forth, as well as you'll hear later on, about some of the, you know, how long they've been and other commitments that they have. And we really then prioritized those that we wanted to consider inviting. For us, we came up with sort of a generalized framework for what those visits would look like so that we could have a similar sort of type of expectations of our campus stakeholders. And that included one multiple participation and presentation events, one that was open to the broadest community. So outside of our campus, outside of even our lifelong learning and inviting the community in. Others targeted to very specific classrooms, as well as discovery topics that sometimes bridged classrooms or disciplinary focuses. One that gave some focus and a more open conversation about the country environment of the scholar. And then we also had some novel formats. For example, we have a celebration of inquiry event that focused on globalization in April 2016. And so our colleague scholar from South Korea was part of a panel that I hosted with four of our faculty members to address positive and negative issues related to globalization. And in addition, all of our invited OLF scholars were interviewed by our Arts and Humanities Global Experience Program to develop a profile of global insight into contemporary issues. This was part of a broader project they were developing. I cannot understate the value of small group meetings that are purposefully set up ahead of time with faculty and staff as well to bring that potential for broader collaboration. We found these sometimes helpful over dinner meals or something like that, but as I said, already one of these is coming to fruition right now for a very specific institutional cooperation event. We used meal events to generate student discussions with the OLF scholar, and give them genuine experiences that were not moderated by their faculty. And that allowed for them to have some very interesting dialogue as well. And then we really developed a general desired plan for that visit that also left time for identifying activities that enhances the scholar's area of interest. So what that allowed then was a conversation with the scholar that said, here's what we're thinking. What would you be interested in? And let us share some things about our area, our region, the areas of focus of our campus. We can go to the next slide, please. We then identified the potential scholars and reached out to them. We communicated the invitation to the scholars in order of prioritization. And that first was an outreach to their host and to the scholar. And then following the directives on the website that are excellent, we developed an invitation notice to CIS and also to the department so that an institution that was hosting the scholar. So it was very clear, not just we were inviting, but all of the parameters and all the pieces. And once those dates and topics were agreed upon, then we finalized the visit by completing and sharing the OLF application, the letter of invitation to the scholar, indicating as well our desire to provide a stipend and a full schedule of the planned visit, so all logistics and arrangements was there. You await the turnaround from CIS, which is extraordinarily fast. That's really wonderful. And we shared all the materials to reconfirm with the scholar and to our coordinating groups on campus to move to implementation. We can go to the implement, engage, and evaluate slide. I would say that one of the things, as soon as we had confirmation, we started to engage our logistics plan, and we began our communication coordination with the scholar and our contacts that we had organized. We put out broader communication pieces to engage all campus groups to participate, as well as community members, and we really wanted to make sure at each of the events there was enough time for individual discussion as well. One of the things you'll be asked to do is to provide a report, so make sure you count participants at the events and record and share, have pictures taken. If you have social media, bring those into play. We filmed every one of the big presentations as well. And finally then, ask after each event for informal feedback with our community college folks. After the first speaker, we made some changes to the format and framework that would happen. That made it a lot better to be able to enhance a better cooperation in the future. Finally, I'd suggest summarize the insights that you've learned after each scholar's visit, because you'll find that those really help to fine-tune the experience for future ones, as well as perhaps to identify groups that maybe could have been involved but weren't in the earlier round. And, of course, complete the online review as soon as possible after each of the visits, especially if you have two in one semester or if you had any more than that, that can be very, very challenging to be reminded of all the details. And so I guess I would conclude my comments by saying that this has been really pivotal for us. It's helped us to broaden value. It's helped us to really anchor our Fulbright Council in a broader range of activities. It's also helped us to be able to bring to campus, as David mentioned, really talented scholars who are experts on whether it's population or digital media or whatever area to augment, supplement, and complement the types of exciting things happening on our campus. And I think over time, the ability of these short contacts, 3 to 5 days in most cases, allow us to have the opportunity to build greater bridges around the world that help to advance our institution's practices with, frankly, a total cost to our campus for each one of these participants of somewhere around $800. And I would argue that that is impossible to do otherwise. So my great appreciation to everybody for all that they do to make the OLF program possible, and I'll turn it back to you, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Darla. It's also just so beneficial for us to hear about the impact that it had, and I think you really hit the nail on the head indicating the idea that it really is an easy way to build bridges with other cultures and with other scholars around the world and around the U.S. One thing that I appreciate that you mentioned was talking about ways to really engage after the fact, and that's summarizing the event and working with us that we can promote it via social media and through blogs and really engage with other institutions, that this is an easy process to work with. David, do you have any thoughts?
No, I think, John, I'm really impressed with what you've done, the way you thoughtfully, you know, determined who you would want as a scholar or scholars, the way you've engaged with them, looking at what they could do on campus, but also, you know, working with your community college down the road and with the general public. You've clearly thought through this, you know, working through your campus committee, determining how this, what the scholars would do, but also the implementation really is what the program's all about. Lots of schools that get engaged with OLF, you may not have a lot of experience with international activities. This is a great way for you to start that process. It's a small step, but it's relatively easy, and it's a way to really build upon the small step that can really you know, take you, you know, large steps further beyond what you're trying to do in terms of internationalization. And I think what Dallas talked about with your campus is a great example of that.
Well, wonderful. And just as a quick note, I meant to mention this earlier, we will be taking questions at the end of this presentation. So you've got, if you have any questions for Darla or David directly, just write them in that chat box and we'll get to all the questions at the end. For now, we're going to move on with the presentation to talk about the application process on our end and how you'd be working with us. As Darla mentioned, she went into great detail and length to make this such a beneficial program. We always want to drive home that this is an easy application process. So in the past, it used to be that scholars applied. Moving forward for the past 3 years and continuing, this is an institutionally driven application and program. So that means that the institutions are looking up scholars, which I'll show you on our website how to do, and they're actually putting in that application to bring to their campus. We do encourage, as you saw in the example before, that these scholars should go to more than one institution. So if you have a neighboring institution that you can partner with, we really like to see those partnerships, that the scholar can see the holistic United States, not just a small liberal arts college, but maybe a community college, maybe a minority-serving institution, maybe a community organization, just to get a better look at what different regions in the U.S. have to offer in the entire academic higher education platform. In terms of eligibility, we do welcome institutions that have applied before, as well as large research institutions, but if that is the case, at least you have to partner, and at least one of those partnering institutions needs to be an institution that we consider priority. These include those minority-serving institutions, community colleges, small liberal arts. They're all listed on the screen that you can see. We've also started to reach out to women's colleges, art institutions, and rural institutions as well. So we do look at that in a very broad sense, and I can show you online where we have a document that goes into these types of institutions that you can see if someone might qualify. In terms of eligibility, the host institution must be an accredited U.S. college or university, and it must be located at least 75 miles from the scholar's primary host institution in the U.S. So if you're looking to request someone into California to go to Southern California, ideally we'd ask that it's a scholar coming from a different state, so maybe Seattle, maybe Texas, but as long as they're more than 75 miles away, maybe in Northern California, that is also acceptable. I will go into this last detail more on the next slide, but it is assumed that the host institutions, such as what Darla mentioned, do cover the lodging and the local transportation, as well as assist in meals and incidentals. OLF is primarily a travel grant. However, we do cover some supplemental costs, and again, I'll go into that more in detail on the next slide. In terms of the eligibility for the visiting scholars, the scholars must be a current Fulbright visiting scholar in the U.S. We're not bringing anyone from overseas. They're already on a grant. Like I said, there's about 800 to 850 at any given point in the United States. And their grants must be longer than 3 months, and I'll show you how you can determine if these scholars meet those criteria. Lastly, these scholars need to possess or be in the current process of applying for a U.S. Social Security number and a U.S. bank account in order for us to pay them for their travel. As I mentioned, with that funding piece, the OLF is a cost-share program, so while we do provide that travel for them to get from their current host institution to your institution for those 3 to 6 days, we do assume that host institutions will also be providing some form of cost-share. If your institution doesn't have the ability to provide that, you can speak with me in greater detail, and we can see about applying for supplemental funding. So in the past, if an institution does struggle with that, we can provide up to government per diem for some of the visits, but again, with it being an application, that's on a case-by-case basis. So please bring that up with me via email or phone, and I'd be happy to go over that in detail. So as I mentioned before, we like to keep this process as easy as possible. We have the graphic on here saying as easy as 1, 2, 3, basically. The first thing an institution would have to do is identify a scholar, and they would search that on the website, which I will show you in one moment. The second step would be contacting the scholar, either through the faculty associate that you would see on the website or going through me. So you would send me an email saying who you're interested in bringing, and I would reach out to them directly. And the last thing you would do is fill out the application form, which is found on our website, and again, I'll show you that right now. So what you're looking at right now is our homepage. In order to get to the OLF website, you would actually go under Programs to U.S. Institutions, and you select the Outreach Lecturing Fund. On our homepage, there's a button that I had mentioned previously. It's a hyperlink built into the main page entitled Priority Institutions. If you were to click and download that, that would generate this Excel document that you could search by state or by city to see if your institution is at the moment considered a priority institution, which means they're underrepresented, or if there's a neighboring institution that you might be able to partner with. So this is a comprehensive but not exhaustive list that you can utilize. Going back to our website, you'd find all information in terms of the application on the application tab for whichever current year you're working on. So the OLF launches every year, and it's a full year on October 1. So if you were looking for next fall, you'd come back later and search in this next section. It's not available, but it will be in the summer. On this, when you're going to download materials, the application form is under Section 2. You would just download that PDF, fill it out, work with me if you have any questions. The other piece that we require is this OLF flyer template. This allows us to promote your your engagement to other local institutions, and I'll go into detail about that a little bit later. But any document you could possibly need is found on this page. Going back to the Fulbright homepage, in order to find a visiting scholar, we actually encourage you to utilize the View the Fulbright Scholar directory. On this directory, there's some key areas that I definitely would insist that you select, but you can customize as much as you want. You'll first want to select that you're looking for a visiting scholar under the scholar type, and then you can actually select the advanced filters. The best way to get to the amount of the current scholars would be selecting the current academic year. You could search here and see that full list of those 800 scholars, or you could then continue to filter by different disciplines. Say you're looking for a certain topic, you could filter by discipline, or you could filter by a certain country of interest. So if you're working on with Ukrainian scholars and you want to bring that into a local history class, you could actually search by that country. So one thing that I will look up is I've always had a passion for archaeology. So we'll search here just to go and look into one scholar in particular. So I'm going to select this first scholar who's from the United Kingdom. When you select their name, you'll be given all the information you could possibly need on this scholar. The first section on your scholar information is exactly who they are and where they're coming from. Their grant information is below. So as you can see here, their start date was September 2016, and their end date is sometime in April. Underneath that, you can see the actual project title to see if that is relevant to the type of archaeology that you're looking into bringing a scholar to discuss. If not, you could go back to that previous page and start looking at other scholars. Noting these end dates, one of the key things to remember is scholars are not eligible to lecture in the last 30 days of their grant period. So that being the case, the scholar couldn't lecture any time in April and most likely for half of the month of March. If you have any questions on their actual official grant end date, again, you can reach out to me at olaf@iie.org, and I can speak and look into any of the details on that. The last piece of information that's listed on this page is where they're hosted in the U.S. So this will help you trying to gauge whether or not they're 75 miles from your institution. You are more than welcome to reach out to their faculty associate who is listed on this page if you want to gather more details by yourself, or again, you can email me and I can look up that information. Going back to the Fulbright Scholar Directory, one other filter that you can utilize is under the project. That's that project title you saw on the other page. So if you're looking for a specific topic, recent ones coming up are EU relations and Brexit, you could actually type in keywords here, and it will pull a full list of any scholar that it will ping on their project title. So those are a couple of ways for you to search the list yourself. Or again, if you want a broader list, you're more than welcome to reach out to me and I can assist you with that process. Going back to the presentation. These are just some screenshots of the process in case you want to look at it later on the PowerPoint. So again, going back to the nitty-gritty of applying, as I mentioned, there's three pieces that you need to submit. That being the OLF application, which you can find on the website, that flyer template on the website, and an official invitation letter on your school's letterhead. If the scholar is going to more than one institution, you'll have to submit one letter for each institution. Please note to apply at least 30 days before the lecture takes place. That way I can go through, review, and make sure everything is eligible. If you have any issues or if you're coming down to that 30-day cutoff period, just reach out to me and we can see if we can work something out. The scholars, as Darla mentioned, are usually at institutions for 2 to 6 days. It doesn't have to be the full 6 days. It's really whatever your schedule allows, as well as the scholar's schedule. And once I review those applications, and you will receive an approval email from me directly giving you the award amount that the scholar can utilize for their flight. We will then take that invitation letter template that you filled out, and I'll circulate that to nearby institutions to really promote your event. The last key piece I would mention is we have a lot of interest in this program, which is a wonderful problem to have. So please allow at least 1 week for me to respond to all the applications, because at any given period, we could have 30 coming in on a given day. So it's a great application. I know many institutions love to utilize it. As I mentioned previously, there is that invitation letter that each institution will have to submit. You might be wondering what you need to include in that. Basically, this is just a letter detailing the visit. So you'll discuss this. You'll name the scholar that you're trying to bring and the date. If you are requesting supplemental funding, this is where you'll make that request, indicating that you need additional funding to host the scholar. You will also, if you're planning on giving the scholar an honorarium, it is not required, but if your institution does choose to do so, you do need to lay out the amount that you're planning on giving to that scholar, so we can then seek approval to ensure that that scholar can actually accept that honorarium. If you have any questions about the invitation letter, please reach out at any time. And again, we always drive home that we do suggest collaboration and partnership with other institutions. So please always consider how else you can benefit the community around you as well as the scholar. After the visit is over, we do require an evaluation to be submitted by every hosting institution in order for us to go ahead and pay those visiting scholars. So the visiting scholars will not receive their funding until we have this evaluation certifying that the event did take place, and it's about 3 to 5 minutes long. It just asks a few questions about the number of people who attended as well as the viewed impact that you saw on your campus. The host, like I said, will fill out that evaluation form, and we also strongly encourage them to submit any local articles that were generated by your school or community, as well as photos and videos. Now, if you would like to also create a blog, we recommend and definitely encourage you to do so. We'll post that on our Fulbright Scholar blog to help promote interest and gather more interest in the program. Darla was wonderful in doing that for us, and it really does generate a lot of support around the Fulbright community. In terms of scholar last bits that we need from them, again, we need that Social Security number and their U.S. banking details in order for us to pay them. So if they have any questions, they can also reach out to us, but just keep in mind that those are the last bits of information that we need. We did have Darla on this line who talked about past successful projects, but we included a few other successful ones. These scholars, as David mentioned, can talk on a variety of subjects, including cultural focus lectures listed on the left, as well as research focused, which are on the right. In the past, some of our more successful ones included a scholar from the United Kingdom who actually gave a few lectures on Edwardian class in England and really focus on Downton Abbey, and it generated a lot of support in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and lasted about 6 days, so it was a very anticipated example on the road. And with that, we can actually move on to the question and answer portion. So again, I'm going to pull up the questions, so if you have any questions for Darla, David, or myself, please submit them to this question box. So we have a question about, is this program open to non-academic professors and students? Is it open to professionals that are currently federal employees? In terms of participating, it is for them to go and actually receive the funding. It's not eligible. If these are governmental workers that wish to work with a local institution bringing a scholar to your campus, that could be arranged. You could reach out to me directly, and we can discuss if that's an option. We currently have a scholar who's trying to go down to NASA in Houston and give a few lectures there, so we do have some non-academic related applications. Are there any visa considerations for host institutions? I do not believe so. These scholars are already on their, they're already on a Fulbright scholar program. I don't know if David has any thoughts on that one.
Right, they're here on a J-1 visa, so that permits them to, you know, carry out their Fulbright activity and to travel throughout the U.S., so there's no additional visa activities that are needed.
Great, thanks, David. How does a research institution identify preferred institutions to partner with this CIS provide assistance? Yes, we do have that document that I mentioned is on the homepage of the Outreach Lecturing Fund. It's titled Priority Institutions. Again, it is a robust list, but it's not exhaustive. So if you do wish to work with me directly via email or phone to try and find another institution nearby, I'd be happy to do so, but you can also consult that list and filter by states and cities just to see who is nearby. That's it there. Do you have any other thoughts, David, while questions are appearing?
The first question, sort of looking at not only the kinds of hosts, but also the kinds of work that scholars are engaged in. The program really is an academic exchange, but you'll notice if you look at the list of the visiting scholars, you'll see people in virtually any academic field, any discipline. You'll see a lot of people who are what we would call professionals, so we're not even necessarily in the academic world at home, and they're doing work in the U.S., but you know, you might be somebody who's working with an NGO. We've got people who've been working in from government ministries, people in all walks of life who've come and done a Fulbright here, not simply somebody's coming from the academic world at home. So it's really a broad-based list. When Sarah talked about 800 scholars, you can imagine, you know, we say it's everything from anthropology to zoology and everything in between, and it's really, really true. You'll see scholars who are at different academic levels. You'll see scholars from different kinds of institutions in their home countries. You'll see scholars from capital cities and small towns. So take a look at that in terms of the kinds of things that you'd want that scholar to bring to campus, not only with their own academic activities and professional activities, but also individually. They represent people from all walks of life in their home countries that can really lend something of interest to you and your campus.
Did you have any comments on that, Darla?
Yeah, I think that is so, so important to consider, and especially for groups that may say, well, this might be too much for us, or they may not be interested in us. And I think what you will find is every one of these scholars, though some will not have been invited to participate in this program yet, and I think you will find them to be very interested in other parts of the United States, other kinds of institutions, and they have questions that they're interested in as well. So I encourage you to reach out and to look at the breadth of them to identify areas that can create some mutual conversation. But also spend some time with that scholar asking, well, we live, you know, telling them about your area so that they can help you to understand. Well, it would be, they may tell you it's very interesting for them to visit with the mayor of a very small town. That may not have occurred to you as being of interest, but that may also be for your community, you know, a very interesting intercultural experience that they would not have otherwise have had an opportunity for. So the benefits here are multidimensional. And just really important to think about on all those levels.
Great. Thanks so much to both of you for talking about that. We had a couple more questions come in. One is going about the partner list in terms of how it was identified. The document that you're speaking about, I hope this answers it, was generated by research on Carnegie classification as well as the U.S. Department of Education, and David actually offered a lot of assistance in identifying those minority-serving institutions. As we mentioned, if you do believe that your institution should be listed on this, send us an email and we can take a look at it. I don't know, David, do you want to talk about your research on the MSI?
Sure. So basically we're talking about 6 or 7 types of institutions that are classified as MSIs, minority-serving institutions, everything from historical black colleges to tribal colleges to Asian-American serving, American Indian serving, predominantly black institutions, Hispanic-serving institutions. Some of these lists are lists that have been in place historically and don't change. Other lists will change year by year based on enrollments. So while the list that Tara is referencing is a really good list and is extensive, it's not exhaustive and it does change a little bit year to year. So if you do think that you belong on the list, you know, be in touch with Sarah. Or if you think that you're wondering whether a school you'd like to partner with belongs on that list, reach out to us and we can give you some further clarification.
And we have another question about access to the slides after the presentation. The webinar will actually be archived within 2 to 3 days and it will be put on the website so you can access it anytime you would like. And in terms of getting access to that, I will also send an email out as soon as that is ready to all attendees and registrants for this webinar. So you will get an email from me with access to that link. I think at the moment that is all, those are all of the questions that we have. Oh, wait. Will the PowerPoint be available down the top? Yes, I do believe that our webmaster actually does include the slides for you to download, so you should be able to have access to that and utilize them as you wish. And if there are no further questions, we can actually end early today. If you do have any questions, let me pull this back up. If you do have any questions, as the screen indicates, you can always reach out to me at olaf@iie.org. We do have one last question. Have you found that visits organized by perhaps a single faculty member tend to be successful, or is it better to have the event organized at a higher level? I've seen success on both accounts. If Darla, do you want to take on this question and talk about this, how you worked with this?
Sure. I think that's a great question. And if I can, I'll answer that, and then I'll also kind of speak a little bit to multiple institutions, if I may, too. Because I think that's a dynamic that is maybe a little bit confusing, too. I think that it can work either way at your institution. For us, in order to get the broad range of cooperation and agreement that came together and has really been astounding here, there was an initiative created that looked at OLF as a model for feeding inquiry and access. And I think that was created across a broad breadth of mainly our humanities college under the leadership of Tripti Pillai, who's just a wonderful, wonderful colleague. But it is also true that the hosting piece requires a lot of work. So, and I don't mean to say that to turn anybody away from it. Rather, I mean that it is helpful to have this group of people so that you have someone picking someone up from the hotel if you don't have an on-campus lodging opportunity for them. Or, you know, and there's groups that take them to dinner. There are groups that facilitate their interaction with students. There are colleagues who are absolutely committed that my class has been redirected that day, and oh, by the way, 3 of these others from my department I'm going to champion as well. And I think that the benefit of having more than one colleague do it is really exceptional, perhaps by a department chair or a program leader or the head of a curriculum. That may also be helpful, but we found that approach with a lot of colleagues who came together on a common topic and theme to be really, really beneficial. And no one felt completely overwhelmed, and everyone was committed that it was something that they definitely wanted to try to continue. With respect to multiple institutions, I will tell you that the question that came on our campus was, well, wait a second, are we responsible for driving these people or getting them to these other institutions of higher education or elsewhere. And what we sort of embraced as our thoughts on it, and then in our colleagues' conversations or our partner conversations, was we sort of broke up the who had which part, and it was a sharing effort where there was agreement up front. And I think if you reach out and you identify another institution, that's a really important part to have up front, because there are resources that are tied to it, financial as well as people resources, that after one or two times might be otherwise exhausted. And I think it can otherwise set the stage, if adopted instead the other way, for a very, very productive continuing engagement.
Great. I think that was very helpful to hear. And I do think, as you were speaking about it, it's a lot easier for institutions that have access to more people assisting with it, but it definitely is feasible for institutions to request and really get a robust program going for these visiting scholars just on the singular level. I think it's whatever is easier for your institution, and if you need that assistance, definitely see if you can gather that from anyone higher up at your institution to really promote it. Just like Darla's event went well, we also saw that in the visiting scholar that went to Tulsa, Oklahoma to speak about Downton Abbey. They actually, it was such a fascinating topic that a local cinema had her appear there and actually give a lecture after a Downton Abbey showing, as well as they brought her into different history classes. So different professors from different campuses around Tulsa, Oklahoma actually requested that scholar. And so it really grew from just one person who had this idea to multiple institutions really wanting to capitalize on that event. So whatever we can do to help facilitate that, we're happy to do. And if you have any other questions, David, do you have thoughts?
Let me add a couple of small things. I think in looking at the way that Darla has utilized OLF, one of the other advantages, I think, of sort of group planning is that you're bringing various people to the table and thinking about the creative ways they can utilize the scholar on campus in the community with visiting campus and so on and so forth. The other thing I would make is, the point I would make is, more generally, you know, this program is paid for with U.S. taxpayers' dollars. It's your program. We would like to see ways that you can help us brand this program, promote it for my brand, into parts of the country perhaps that are less familiar with Fulbright. People think, oh, Fulbright, I've heard of that. Wouldn't that send to Fulbright's foundation? No, that's paid for with U.S. taxpayers' dollars. It's your program. We want to see you utilize it. And want to see ways that we can help promote people's better understanding of what Fulbright's all about, opportunities, program offers, the objectives of the program, and promoting mutual understanding between Americans and people from other countries. Think about ways that you'd utilize these scholars. Think about within the community, for example. Could they perhaps be visiting, local schools, K-12 schools or school districts, global classroom kinds of things. While it's an academic exchange, and while we're talking about a scholar who's, you know, working at the post-secondary level, there's a whole variety of ways, I think, that you can utilize the scholars in creative ways that we think is terrific and is a win-win for you and clearly a win for those scholars as well, because they're more broadly engaged than with the community that they're visiting.
Mm-hmm. And as we discussed, the OLF is a very low-hanging fruit. We saw that in the past. We referred to it as a gateway Fulbright, that many institutions start with this and then go on later to actually hosting a Fulbright scholar for a full academic year through the Scholar in Residence program and through other programs and avenues. So however you want to develop and grow from this, we definitely encourage it, and we're happy to provide whatever resources and help that we can. The last question that I have listed is discussing if U.S. researchers and faculty can visit other countries for short durations, say a week under the OLF program. Unfortunately, that's not the scope of Outreach Lecturing Fund. This is only for current visiting scholars in the U.S. If you are interested in other opportunities on going abroad, I would definitely point you in the direction of our website or email me, and I can pass it along to appropriate staff that they can potentially help you. There's opportunities like the IEA programs, as well. I'm trying to think. What are the options?
For my specialist grant,
yeah,
where you can go overseas for a 2 to 6 week period. Programs for administrators on campuses who are involved in international education themselves. Academic opportunities to lecturing or research or combined activities. Opportunities for students at the post-baccalaureate level to go overseas for a year to study, to conduct research, or to serve as a teaching assistant. So Fulbright is not just one program, it's a constellation of programs. And hopefully by engaging with the OLF, you'll have a better sense of what those programs are and how to take advantage of them.
And if that's the last question that we have, we thank you so much for participating today and listening in. And I want to extend my gratitude to both Darla and David for really sitting in on this call and offering their expertise. If you have any questions, as I mentioned, you can reach out to OLF at IIE.org. If you can get this page to go forward. There's a few other links that on this page that you'll have access to when you can download the PowerPoint about ways to get involved in. Ensure that you're receiving the most updated information that I'd encourage you to look at. Definitely want to make a pitch that if you want to serve as the liaison for the Fulbright Scholar Program on your campus, please do so. You can check online on our website if there's a person in that role on your campus, as well as you can actually host a staff member or a Fulbright Scholar Ambassador on your campus for more information sessions. But again, thank you so much to both Darla and David. And if you have any closing words.
We appreciate you tuning in. We hope that you found this informational and inspirational, and really encourage you to take advantage of the opportunity.
Thank you all for the opportunity to share today and for all that you do to make this program possible for all of us and for all of these scholars.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Have a good one.